Hope you brought your Bibles with you tonight. We're going to be studying in 1 Corinthians chapters 7 and 8 this evening. You may already have known this, and we've had it in our announcements, but our Bible Bowl is tomorrow night for our kids here. And so the Bible Bowl test is over 1 Corinthians chapters 5, 6, 7, and 8. And that's a lot of material for them to think about. And so as they've been studying on Wednesday nights, there's going to be a study session tonight after this service. And we certainly want our Bible Bowl participants to stay after the service tonight so that Scott can meet with them and study. But we've also been studying this material on Sunday evening, just by way of review, just by way of looking at the book of 1 Corinthians and studying the material that's in there. And remembering the great theme of the book of 1 Corinthians, God's wisdom versus man's wisdom. And we see that God's wisdom leads us to some wonderful things, but man's wisdom leads to all kinds of problems, and mainly division within the church because of various different things that man pursues in his wisdom. But God's wisdom leads us to unity and blessedness. And that's what we want within our life, a unity with our fellow Christian, and blessedness for our own life itself. Now, the structure of the book of 1 Corinthians is basically along these lines. There were a lot of questions. Perhaps the household of Chloe had sent a letter to the Apostle Paul, or maybe even sent a messenger to the Apostle Paul to communicate some of the issues that were going on in the church at Corinth, and also to ask some questions. And chapter 7 is one of those questions that, or several questions that are being dealt with. And a lot of these questions are questions about marriage. And so the Apostle Paul is going to answer. He's having a question and answer session, more or less, here in the book of 1 Corinthians. And he's answering questions in chapter 7 regarding marriage. And in chapter 8, he's answering questions related to the individual conscience, and specifically in regard to eating things offered to idols. And so we'll talk about that in just a moment. But right now, let's get to chapter 7, and let's look at verses 1 through 9 as we look at some principles of marriage. And notice in verse 1, Paul talks about the things that they wrote to him. Now concerning the things of which you wrote to me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, because of sexual immorality, let each man have his own wife, and let each woman have her own husband. Let the husband render to his wife the affection due her, and likewise also the wife to her husband. The wife does not have authority over her own body, but the husband does. And likewise, the husband does not have authority over his own body, but the wife does. Do not deprive one another, except with consent for a time, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer, and come together again so that Satan does not tempt you because of your lack of self-control. But I say this as a concession, not as a commandment. For I wish that all men were even as I myself. But each one has his own gift from God, one in this manner and another in that. But I say to the unmarried and to the widows, it is good for them if they remain even as I am. But if they cannot exercise self-control, let them marry, for it is better to marry than to burn with passion. So in verses 1 through 9, Paul is talking about the general question of whether or not Christians ought to marry. There is no command for Christians to marry. It is an option. And that is what Paul is basically saying here. But there's circumstances under which it is better to marry, and there's other circumstances under which it is better to remain single, is basically what he's saying in this section. Now, he is talking about, in verse 2, avoiding sexual immorality or fornication. And to do that, to avoid that, it is best for a man and a woman to marry. and to therefore satisfy these types of desires within the marriage relationship. And he makes it clear in verses 3 and 4 and 5 that this is part of the purpose of marriage, is for husband and wife to come together in this very special way, speaking this language that only husband and wife may speak to one another in marriage. And so in that relationship, he is saying that the husband is to give the wife her due and the things that she desires, and that the wife is to give her husband his due and the things that he desires. And so marriage, when it's done correctly, is a state in which both husband and wife dwell together in humility, because it is a situation where one will be submitting to the other, and vice versa as well. And then there's only one exception for there to be a break in the regular communication of this kind in marriage. And that exception is if you want to depart from one another for a time for prayer and fasting. And you do that so that you can get spiritually stronger. But then after that time that has been set aside for those spiritual activities is over, you are to come back together again so that Satan does not tempt you. And that is something that happens in marriage a lot. Satan does end up tempting either husband or wife to be unfaithful to one another. And as a result of that, marriages can fall apart. And so if we would have strong marriages, we would need to abide by the instruction that the Apostle Paul gives here to both husbands and wives. And if we follow that instruction, then those marriages can be strong. Now, Paul says this is a concession, not a commandment in verse 6. In other words, if you're in the situation where you feel like you need to get married so as to avoid fornication, then he said, go ahead and do that by all means. But if you're not in that situation, if those desires are not so strong within you, and it's the case that there are some that are like that in this world, then Paul says it is best to remain single. And he's going to give reasons for that later on in the chapter. But here he simply says that it's best that they remain as himself, and that each one exercise his own gift from God in that manner. And so he gives the same advice to widows as well, verse 8. And also, if they desire to marry, they can go ahead and marry as well, according to verse 9. Now let's read verses 10 through 16. Now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband, but even if she does depart, let her remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband. And a husband is not to divorce his wife, but to the rest I, not the Lord, say, if any brother has a wife who does not believe, and she is willing to live with him, let him not divorce her. And a woman who has a husband who does not believe, if he is willing to live with her, let her not divorce him. For the unbelieving husband is sanctified by the wife, and the unbelieving wife is sanctified by the husband. Otherwise, your children would be unclean, but now they are holy. But if the unbeliever departs, let him depart. A brother or a sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. For how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? Paul draws upon Jesus' teaching from Matthew chapter 19 and verses 1 and following, where the Pharisees specifically ask Jesus whether or not Moses allowed them to divorce. And so look at Matthew chapter 19 for just a moment, and starting in verse 3. The Pharisees also came to him, testing him and saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And now Jesus answers them in verse 4. He answered and said to them, have you not read, that he who made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So then, they are no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let not man separate. And that's the teaching that Paul is referring to from Jesus in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 10, when he says, now to the married I command, yet not I, but the Lord. A wife is not to depart from her husband, and so also the husband is not to depart from the wife. And Jesus said as much when he said in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 6, what God has joined together, let not man separate. Well, then we get into the question of divorce. And so Jesus is asked about that in verse 7. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and to put her away? He said to them, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. But from the beginning, it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife, except for sexual immorality, and marries another, commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced, commits adultery. And so that is Jesus' teaching on the topic of divorce. There's only one reason for it, and that is if there is sexual immorality involved in an unfaithful way. Everything else, Jesus said, is tantamount to adultery. And so that is the situation that Paul is drawing upon here in 1 Corinthians chapter 7. So let's see what he says then in verses 12 and following. He says, but to the rest, I, not the Lord, say. Now, what is he talking about here when he means I, not the Lord? Well, he means that the Lord hasn't specifically commented upon these particular kinds of cases, although in principle, the Lord had given the instruction for marriage and divorce that we just read back in Matthew chapter 19. And so he says this, if a brother has a wife who does not believe, and that's the circumstance that he is dealing with, a situation where you have a Christian who's married to a non-Christian, and what is one supposed to do in that circumstance? Now, Jesus never commented on that circumstance, all right? So Paul is going to clarify that in this letter. If a brother has a wife who does not believe and she is willing to live with him, don't divorce her. And the same also for a woman who has a husband who does not believe, don't let her divorce him. In other words, don't divorce, more or less. That's something that God hates, according to the book of Malachi, chapter 2, I believe it is, verse 14 and following. And so Christians do not want to be involved in divorce if they can help it. There is one exception to that, as we also already mentioned. Well, what if then the unbelieving spouse decides to leave? What is the Christian supposed to do in that situation? And since the instruction has already been given that you're not supposed to divorce, maybe the thought on the part of the Christian is, well, I should leave Christianity and I should go with my spouse to ensure the unity of the marriage so that I can be faithful in my marriage. Maybe that's what the thought is to one who is married to an unbeliever, a Christian who is married to an unbeliever. And that, I believe, is what Paul is addressing in this context. And so he says, if the unbelieving husband, if the unbeliever departs, verse 15, a brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. In other words, not under bondage to leave Christ in order to preserve the marriage. If an unbeliever departs, be faithful to Christ, but let the unbeliever depart. That's the point that Paul is trying to make here. For how do you, and then of course he says, God called us to peace. Verse 16, for how do you know, O wife, whether you will save your husband, or how do you know, O husband, whether you will save your wife? And so it's good then for Christians to be who are married to non-Christians to stay married because they may very well lead their spouse to Christ. Let's look at verses 17 through 24. But as God has distributed to each one, as the Lord has called each one, so let him walk. And so I ordain in all the churches. Was anyone called while circumcised? Let him not become uncircumcised. Was anyone called while uncircumcised? Let him not be circumcised. Circumcision is nothing, and uncircumcision is nothing. But keeping the commandments of God is what matters. Let each one remain in the same calling in which he was called. Were you called while a slave? Do not be concerned about it. But if you can be made free, rather use it. For he who is called in the Lord while a slave is the Lord's freedman. Likewise, he who is called while free is Christ's slave. You are bought at a price. Do not become slaves of men. Brethren, let each one remain with God in that state in which he was called. And so what is Paul talking about here? He's talking about the situation in which you were when you became a Christian. If you were a slave when you became a Christian, then he's not saying that if you become a Christian, that makes you a freedman automatically. You will still be a slave in that regard. And you shouldn't try to change that situation necessarily unless it is something that you can do easily. Now, some commentators have stated that what was going on here at Corinth was that some Christians were selling themselves into slavery so that they could free others who were in slavery and were in difficult situations. And Paul is advising against that sort of behavior. And so he says to those who are free to stay free, and those who are slaves to stay slaves unless they can get out of that, in which case they should be able, that's okay. But then also about the circumcised and the uncircumcised. He doesn't want them to worry about that situation either. If you are called while circumcised, then stay circumcised. If you're called while uncircumcised, stay uncircumcised. That doesn't mean anything. A person doesn't have to change that simply because they become a Christian. And so in whatever state we are when we're called, we should remain in that state. So how does that apply to us today, you might ask? Well, if you were a teacher when you were called, then stay a teacher. You don't have to become something else just because you become a Christian. If you were a police officer, then stay as a police officer. If you are called being married, then stay married. If you're called not married, then you don't have to get married just because you become a Christian. Okay? And so there are a lot of situations in which we're called. We can't name all of them. But Paul is saying that unless there's something inherently sinful about what you're doing for a living or what your circumstances are, you don't need to change that. That can stay the same. Now, we know that he's not talking about sinful situations because those who are called to become Christians are called to give up the sin that they practice within their life. If someone was, for example, a prostitute before they became a Christian, then they would have to give up prostitution. If someone was a professional thief before they became a Christian, then they would have to give up professional thievery. You know, if it's a sinful situation that you're involved in, you have to leave it behind before you can start living faithfully to the Lord. And that certainly does need to change. But Paul doesn't have that under consideration in this context, in 17 through 24. Let's read 25 and following. Now concerning virgins, I have no commandment from the Lord, yet I give judgment as one whom the Lord in his mercy has made trustworthy. I suppose, therefore, that this is good because of the present distress, that it is good for a man to remain as he is. Are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be loosed. Are you loosed from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But even if you do marry, you have not sinned. And if a virgin marries, she has not sinned. Nevertheless, such will have trouble in the flesh. But I would spare you. But this I say, brethren, the time is short. so that from now on even those who have wives should be as though they had none, those who weep as though they did not weep, those who rejoice as though they did not rejoice, those who buy as though they did not possess, and those who use this world as not misusing it. For the form of this world is passing away. But I want you to be without care. He who is married cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married, he who is unmarried cares for the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord. But he who is married cares about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. Let's stop there for a minute. What is Paul talking about here? He's explaining a little bit more about the statement that he made earlier as to why it would be best for a person to remain single. There was some present distress, verse 26, that he has under consideration in this context that made it difficult for a husband and a wife to live together as faithful Christians. Some have speculated that this was some kind of persecution that was coming upon the church at Corinth, or that was about to come upon the church at Corinth. We know that under Nero's reign, that there was persecution of the church in Rome and in some of the outlying areas of Rome, and even in some of the other Roman colonies and Roman cities that were in the Roman world in that day and time. And so Paul, it may be that that is what Paul has in mind. And he understands that if a person is married, then his concerns are going to be for his wife, or her concerns are going to be for her husband. And with persecution coming, if that persecution comes on one of them, then the other might be tempted to give up Christianity to save his or her spouse, and vice versa. And in that regard, Paul says, it is better if you remain unmarried, because then you do not have, under that situation, in that circumstance, with the present distress of what he's talking about, you don't have that relationship to be concerned about. And that's why he says that the married care about the things of the world, how he may please his wife or his spouse or her spouse, and that those who are unmarried can focus solely on the things of the Lord and being faithful to the Lord, because there's not another person there that you have to be concerned about protecting in such a circumstance as the present distress that Paul mentions in verse 26. Now, what is this business about virgins? Let's look at verse 34. There is a difference between a wife and a virgin. The unmarried woman cares about the things of the Lord, and she may be holy both in body and in spirit. But she who is married cares about the things of the world, how she may please her husband. And this I say for your own profit, not that I may put a leash on you, but for what is proper, and that you may serve the Lord without distraction. But if any man thinks he is behaving improperly toward his virgin, if she is past the flower of youth, and thus it must be, let him do what he wishes. He does not sin, let them marry. Nevertheless, he who stands steadfast in his heart, having no necessity, but has power over his own will, and has so determined in his heart that he will keep his virgin, does well. So then, he who gives her in marriage does well, and he who does not give her in marriage does better. Let's stop right there. Paul is addressing fathers of young women at this point and their eligibility for marriage. And he's saying if your daughter is a Christian, it's better for her not to marry given this circumstance of the present distress. But if you do give her to someone to be married, that's certainly fine. There's nothing wrong with that. This was, of course, back in a day when the parents still controlled the marriages of the children. Children didn't go off and form their own relationships independent of the parents' wishes like they do today, but rather it was the parents' responsibility to arrange marriages for the children in this particular time. And so the parents set that up, And it was the father's specific responsibility to make sure that that happened and that his daughter was taken care of and that he found her a suitable groomsman so that she could have someone who would take care of her in this particular day and time. And so if that's a concern of his, then he needs to go ahead and find someone for her to marry. But if it's not a concern, if she can live as a independent young woman and be financially well off, then Paul says it's better that she doesn't marry given the present distress. Now let's look at verses 39 and 40. A wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. But if her husband dies, she is at liberty to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord. But she is happier if she remains as she is, according to my judgment. And I think I also have the Spirit of God. So, a wife is bound by law as long as her husband lives. And that's the same principle that he stated earlier. In essence, if you are married, don't seek a divorce. That's basically what his advice was earlier in the chapter. And so you're bound by marriage to stay married. But then he says, if her husband dies, she's at liberty to marry. And so this is a principle that Paul also speaks of in Romans chapter 7. And he uses this principle to illustrate that we're married to Christ. But notice what he says in Romans chapter 7 and verse 2. For the woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. But if her husband dies, she is released from the law of her husband. So then, if while her husband lives, she marries another man, she will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she is free from that law so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Now, what is the only stipulation that Paul gives upon widows to remarry? That they must remarry in the Lord. There's been two different interpretations of what that means. One interpretation is that she must marry a Christian. The other interpretation is that she must marry according to the commandments of marriage that Jesus gave. Now, given both of those interpretations, there's been some debate over that. I'm going to only say that it is my view that in the Lord here in this context means according to the commandments that Jesus gave. And so she would be free to marry anyone who the Lord said was authorized to be married. All right, let's finish up chapter 8 and then we'll be done. Now concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. Knowledge puffs up, but love edifies. And if anyone thinks that he knows anything, he knows nothing yet as he ought to know. But if anyone loves God, this one is known by him. Therefore, concerning the eating of things offered to idols, we know that an idol is nothing in the world, and that there is no other God but one. But even if there are so-called gods, whether in heaven or on earth, as there are many gods and many lords, yet for us there is one God, the Father, of whom are all things, and we for him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, through whom are all things, and through whom we live. However, there is not in everyone that knowledge. For some, with consciousness of the idol, until now, eat it as a thing offered to an idol, and their conscience, being weak, is defiled. But food does not commend us to God, for neither if we eat are we the better, nor if we eat or do not eat are we the worse. But beware lest somehow this liberty of yours become a stumbling block to those who are weak. For if anyone sees you who have knowledge eating in an idol's temple, will not the conscience of him who is weak be emboldened to eat those things offered to idols? And because of your knowledge shall the weak brother perish for whom Christ died? But when you thus sin against the brethren and wound their weak conscience, you sin against Christ. Therefore, if food makes my brother stumble, I will never again eat meat, lest I make my brother stumble. What is the Apostle Paul talking about here? He's talking about the circumstance in which you go to the market and you buy meat in the open market, and that meat has probably been offered to some idol somewhere in some temple, and then after it was offered to that idol in that temple as a sacrifice, that is, that's where it was cooked, then it was taken to a market stall and sold on the open market. And so if you find that meat being sold on the open market, you're not supposed to ask whether or not it was offered to an idol or not. You're supposed to just buy it and take it home and eat it. And you don't have to worry about whether or not it was offered to an idol or not, because idols are nothing, and they don't cause meat to be tainted spiritually simply because they were offered, simply because that meat was offered to an idol. Now, that's the person who has the strong conscience. A person with a weak conscience in this section of Scripture that Paul is describing, a person who has a weak conscience would be very concerned about whether or not that meat was offered to an idol. And in going to the market, he or she would ask, was this meat offered to an idol? And if it was, he or she would not partake of that meat because they would offend their conscience. Now, what some brethren had been doing was taking that meat and then bringing others over and then having dinner with them and then informing them that this meat was offered to an idol. And here I am, a bigger Christian, because it doesn't bother me one bit knowing that this meat was offered to an idol, and thus offending the conscience of the weaker brethren who are concerned about eating meat that is offered to idol. And Paul says, don't do that. Don't cause your brother to stumble in conscience. If it offends his conscience to do something, then you should not do that around him, whether it's right or wrong. It's something that would be right, but it would be wrong to offend the conscience, okay? And in thinking about this issue, we don't want to offend anyone's conscience in the sense that we get them involved in something that would violate their conscience. Turn back to Romans chapter 15 for just a moment, and then the lesson will be your, or Romans chapter 14 for just a moment, and the lesson will be yours. Now, Romans chapter 14, Paul talks about some similar things there. And he says in verse 22, do you have faith? Have it to yourself before God. Happy is he who does not condemn himself in what he approves. And then in verse 23, he says, but he who doubts is condemned if he eats, because he does not eat from faith. For whatever is not from faith is sin. So there can be something that's right and good to participate in, but because we don't think that it's right or good to participate in, we can offend our conscience and so sin against God by participating in that kind of activity. And that's what Paul is prohibiting the brethren to do here in chapter 8. He's saying, don't deliberately offend someone else's conscience because they don't believe that eating meat offered to idols is right. Don't deliberately offend them because of that. Let them work that out on their own. And you eat your meat in your own household with your good conscience, and let them eat what they want to eat in their household under their conscience, but not to violate the conscience. That's the thing that he's trying to get them to avoid here. And so he says, if I have to eat just vegetables in front of a brother who believes it's wrong to eat meat, then I'll just eat vegetables. No problem. And you say, well, that sounds like a kind of a strange thing to do. But you know, there's some brothers and sisters of ours in India where they prohibit the eating of meats very strictly, that will not eat meats and who would be offended if you were to eat meat around them, even today. Well, in that circumstance, in that situation, I would avoid eating meat around them. Now, if we're here in the United States and there's people who eat meat all the time and I'm about to chow down on a big hamburger, then look out, you know. But if we're over there in India where they don't eat meat, I'm not about to go and walk up and slaughter a cow just so I can have my hamburger, you know. I'm going to obey and respect their customs that they have in that regard. And I'm not going to cause my brother or sister's conscience to be violated and for them to stumble and to think that they've done something they ought not to have done. And that's the principle that the Apostle Paul is teaching here in chapter 8. All right, so we've discussed some things that have to do with practical Christian living tonight in these chapters. Things related to marriage and things related to helping one another get to heaven in the sense that we are not going to be unduly offensive to others in seeking to get them to violate their consciences. But we certainly want to teach the message of the gospel to everyone, that Jesus came to this earth to die on the cross that we might have the forgiveness of our sins. And he wants everyone to take advantage of the shedding of his blood so that they can be saved. God did love the world. He did send his only begotten son so that men could be saved. And that opportunity exists today through the teaching and preaching of Jesus Christ. Now, Jesus gave some commands that we need to obey, like we discussed this morning, whereby when we obey them, we come into that blood-bought covenant with Jesus Christ. That is, by hearing his word and believing it, repenting of sins, confessing him as Lord, and being baptized for the forgiveness of sins. And once we're in that covenant with him, then he forgives us of our sins. And so we then turn our lives over to him, and we want him to direct our lives. We want Jesus to guide our lives. And that's what this is about here. This is about the Christians in Corinth who were struggling with issues, practical issues, about how is it that Jesus should guide my life? And that's why Paul answers these questions that he answers here in chapter 7 and 8. And so if someone is here tonight who would like to become a child of God, to let Jesus guide their life, to be under a covenant relationship with God in Jesus Christ, to be a member of his body, the Church of Jesus Christ, and you would like to become a Christian this evening, we can help you do that through the pattern that Jesus left for us to obey so that we can know that we're saved. And if there's someone who needs the prayers of the church this evening, then we invite you to come as well while we stand and while we sing.